Welcome to Heart of Iowa at KHOI Community Radio. Today we bring you the keynote address by Robert Reich, delivered at the May 16th Working Families Summit in Ames, sponsored by labor groups and progressive organizations from Iowa. Robert Reich was the Secretary of Labor under Bill Clinton and is the director of a recent film, Inequality for All, which won an award at the 2013 Sundance Film Festival.
I appreciate it. Thank you. I want to thank everybody who's been behind this day. You know, it's not easy to put on a day like this. And there are a lot of organizers and people. And every time I say to somebody who I know participated, I say thank you. And they say, oh, I'm just one of many, many people. Which makes me understand why it is so successful. When people don't take the credit, when they say, oh, I'm only one of just many people, I know that it is the kind of organization that works. As you can see, the economy has worn me down. I was actually always short. In fact, when I was a little boy, I was even shorter. I was very short. I was always short for my age, and I was always, you know, when you're a kid, a lot of people get teased and they get bullied and they get, and I was teased and I was bullied and I was occasionally beat up and I didn't want to go to the men's room, the boys' room, because the bullies there would just, so I developed a way of actually keeping the bullies at bay. And that was I made alliances with older boys, to kind of be my protectors. I had a little protection racket. And it worked pretty well. And one of the older boys, well, I lost track of most of them. And I got kind of over the bullying stage. In the summer of 64, I learned that one of my protectors, by then I was, you know, I was going to college. But one of my protectors, who I had lost sight of for years, was down in Mississippi registering voters. And his name was Mickey. I knew him as Mickey. And he, along with two other civil rights workers, were brutally murdered. Mickey Schwerner was his name, Michael Schwerner. And when I heard that Michael Schwerner and his two colleagues that Freedom Summer were tortured and murdered by the real bullies, something sort of snapped inside me. And I knew that I had to work to stop the bullying of Americans in whatever form or shape people were bullied. And there's a lot of bullying going on. A lot of it is economic bullying. A lot of it is bullying by employers. A lot of it is bullying by politicians, by people who are wealthy, by big corporations. Most Americans today feel powerless and they feel cynical and they feel helpless, like I did as a little boy. They feel vulnerable. We're talking about working families. You know, I think you know exactly what's happened to working families. We've talked about it all day. I mean, you look at the difference between when I was growing up, between 1946. I was born in 1946. That was the beginning of the baby boom. Bill Clinton was born in 1946. George W. Bush was born in 1946. Cher. Anybody who's anybody was born in 1946. And the baby boomers, they started, but you know, between 1946 and about 1980, the economy did pretty well. In fact, the median wage, we're not talking average wages. Whenever somebody talks average, whenever you hear an economist say average with regard to wages or anything else, watch your wallet. You know, the basketball player Shaquille O'Neal and I have an average height of 5'10". You get my drift. I mean, you can't. Averages are pulled up by people at the top. So when you look at wages, it's median. And in between 1946 and 1980, the median wage that is half above, half below, grew very fast as the economy grew. In fact, you could plot the median wage and the economy grew together. In fact, the people who were in the bottom 20%, that segment of the population grew faster than people who were in the top 20%. We were well on our way to becoming a much more egalitarian society. It wasn't perfect. Women still were second-class citizens. Blacks were still second-class citizens. We worked hard with regard to the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act and opening possibilities for women. We as a country were working hard. We were not nearly perfect. But then something happened. Class. Well, some of you say Ronald Reagan, and I think you are right. I can't pull this. I'm going to have to. I like to walk around when I'm talking. So, yeah, certainly it was around the time of Ronald Reagan. But if you look closely and compare 1946 to the period 1946 to 1980 with what's happened over the last 35 years, not only have wages not risen with economic growth, but they've flattened. Median wage has flattened. The economy is almost twice as large as it was in 1980. But where did all of the money go? It went to the top. It went to big corporations, but their shareholders were mostly wealthy, and also their CEOs, and it went to Wall Street. It went up. The big story, contrasting the first era, of 1946 to 1980 with the second era, 1980 to today, the big difference is wages. Middle class, working class wages. And of course, it also means that the poor could not, in this new second era, really move into the middle class because the middle class started to stagnate and shrink. You can't move into a middle class that is shrinking. It's harder. It's harder to do. There are fewer places to move into. People are scared. They're going to be less generous. Now, what formula did we understand between 1946 and 1980 that we forgot? What's the collective amnesia that enables us to forget what happened between 1946 and 1980 so that we don't even know, we don't even remember what we did right? People ask me, what country should we emulate? I say we should emulate America. When we created the largest middle class the world had ever seen, when we had upward mobility, when we were on the road to equal opportunity. Well, one thing we did is we invested substantially in education, in public education, in good K through 12, in higher education. We invested in infrastructure. We paid teachers more. We actually understood that our future depended on public investments, and we made them. Now, how could we afford those public investments? Well, first of all, when the middle class is doing better and better, there are more tax revenues, but also the highest tax bracket, the people at the very top. We said you ought to be paying a rate that is much, much higher than people in the middle. We had a progressive, what was called a progressive income tax, which meant that people at the very top, in the top bracket, between 1946 and 1981, they never paid below 70%. And under Dwight David Eisenhower, who, remember, was a Republican, the marginal income tax on the top incomes was 91%. Can you imagine today arguing for a 91% tax on the top income? But what that did, when you had a middle class that was growing and you had enough tax revenues coming from the middle class, and you had people at the top who were paying that kind of a marginal tax at the very top, you had revenues, and you could take the revenues and you could actually rebuild the country. You could invest it in infrastructure and in education and in basic research and development. You could grow the country and grow the middle class. We also had element number three, we had strong labor unions. Now, it was not controversial at least not after the Treaty of Detroit, 1950, we had strong labor unions, and those labor unions lifted the middle class. By 1955, 35% of the private sector workers of America, 35%, over a third of every private sector worker in America, were unionized. And when you have that many people unionized, those unionized contracts with regard to wages and working conditions, they actually affected the non-unionized sector, because the non-unionized workers and their employers thought, well, you know, if we don't do the same thing, those employers said, we're going to be unionized next. So they set the prevailing wages across America. And when you had that kind of bargaining power in the middle class and in the working class, that meant that the middle class and working class actually, with that bargaining power, could take a share of the gains from growth, a fair share of the gains from economic growth. And finally, we had a fourth very important element, which was Wall Street was boring. Finance was boring. I remember in the 50s, people joked about how boring. I mean, if you wanted to do anything in America, the last place you thought about going to was Wall Street. That was boring. Boring. We also had a minimum wage, by the way, by 1968, that in today's dollars, adjusted for inflation, would be today $10.80 an hour. What happened? We reversed course. We did a giant U-turn. We didn't even know we were doing it. Well, Ronald Reagan is part of it, but Ronald Reagan is just a piece of it. We did it in many ways. We didn't even know we were doing it. We gradually disinvested in education and infrastructure as a percentage of our national economy. We reduced taxes dramatically. The middle class wages stagnated, unions declined, Wall Street started to run the economy. And other things like the minimum wage started to drop. In other words, the inequality we are now seeing and experiencing, and we've experienced this for 30 years, the stagnant wages that we've experienced for 30 years, are a choice we made. We being who? Well, the question is, who's we? Who actually made this choice? How did it happen? Because, you know, if we want to really change direction, we got to understand how it happened. How did it happen? Voters? What? You're all talking at the same time. I have no idea what you're saying. But let me venture, because I lived through this, as many of you lived through it. I lived through it too. Well, first of all, a lot of Americans who were stuck, that is, their wages started to stagnate. And if the bottom, we're talking about the bottom 80% hourly wage workers, they actually, the men, and they were mostly male workers, they actually went downstream. Poor women were working all the time. But we're talking about working class, middle class. Women basically were not in the workforce until the late 70s, early 1980s. And we saw this huge wave of women going to work. Now, I wish I could tell you the reason that young wives and mothers went to work, starting in the late 70s and in the 1980s even more. I wish I could tell you this was because of these wonderful professional opportunities suddenly open to women. That's not why most women went to work. They went to work to prop up family incomes that were shrinking because male wages were going down. And then when that coping mechanism, let's call it a coping mechanism, when that coping mechanism was exhausted, that's coping mechanism number one. When that was exhausted, what was the second coping mechanism? Everybody worked longer hours. Everybody. By the 1990s, we were putting in more hours than the overly industrious typical Japanese. Everybody was working all hours. Wives, husbands, partners. I was Secretary of Labor at the time, and I looked at the data. I couldn't believe it. I came up with an acronym to describe these families that everybody was working. DINS, D-I-N-S, double income, no sex. I don't know how we reproduced in those years. And then when that, we kind of, we, that coping mechanism, you can't, you know, can't go on forever working like those hours. And then we came up with a third coping mechanism. I'm talking about coping with flat wages, continuing to live a lifestyle that we thought was pretty good. The third coping mechanism, after we had wives and mothers in the workforce and we were all working all these hours, the third one was we used our houses as piggy banks, because housing prices were going up in the late 90s and early part of this century, and we could get refinancing and we could get loans, and we thought that we struck it rich and we kept on going. And then came, of course, the bubble burst in 2008. And since 2008, we've become aware of something. Politically, we've become aware. We started to become aware. People started to talk about this around 2009, 2010. Wait a minute. Wages have gone nowhere. Wages have gone nowhere, and all the gains are going to the top. Maybe there's something wrong. And here's what gives me some cause for optimism, that even as late as 5 years ago, 6 years ago, 7 years ago, I never heard a single Republican talk about this problem. Democrats began talking about it. But you know something? In this early days of the presidential election coming up, almost every Republican candidate is talking about the problem of the middle class. Now, they're not doing anything about it, and they won't, but at least they're, now this is a nonpartisan group, so I'm not gonna denigrate Republicans. The problem, but at least they're recognizing, but you know what? They can't avoid the problem because people understand. People are getting it. They're also getting something else. They're getting, did you say screwed? Restrain yourselves, please. I was going to say that they're also getting wind of the fact that the economy, the system, has been rigged. They've rigged. They rigged it. Here's what you've got to get in your mind. I want to connect the dots. Because as you've got more and more of the economic, you know, income and wealth going to the top, a piece of that income and wealth going to the top is being used and has been used for 30 years to finance politics. And that political financing is not for nothing. That is to rig the rules of the game. It's not only to rig the rules of the game, but it's also for the purposes of propaganda. One piece of propaganda you've heard about, and it started under Reagan big time. It didn't start, I mean, we've had it for years, but one big piece of propaganda is that there's something called a free market out there. And that government is over here. Government is bad. And then over here, you've got a free market. And this is good. And sometimes, you know, you've got to shrink the government and you've got to let the free market rip. Well, here is why this is propaganda. There is no such thing as a free market in nature. Free markets, property, contract, liability, bankruptcy, taxes, free markets are created by people, by politicians, by judges, by administrative agencies. They are constantly creating and recreating and revising the rules of the so-called free market. You can't separate government from the free market. Government is defining the market. And that's the problem, because with all this money coming in, you're buying off the people who are organizing the market for the advantage of the people who are already getting benefits. And when that happens, you see, you create this giant vicious cycle in which people at the top who are already doing extraordinarily well are using some of their money to rig the market and make it so that they'll do even better. Do you understand how the compounding of this works? I mean, look at Wall Street. Wall Street, now remember, it was boring. It used to be boring. Wall Street was unleashed. And I'm embarrassed to say that some of that unleashing happened, not on my watch, thank goodness I was gone, but under the Clinton administration. We got rid of the Glass-Steagall Act. Now, I want you to say, now, Hillary Clinton is I've known her since she was 19 years old, but when she comes to town, you just ask her, are you going to resurrect the Glass-Steagall Act? Or how about the biggest banks? Now, this is an important little statistics, and I hate to give you statistics because statistics are pretty boring, but I want to give you this. In 1990, the top biggest five banks on Wall Street had 10% of total banking assets. Today, after the big bank explosion, after we went through everything with the Great Recession, today, the five biggest banks on Wall Street have 45% of total banking assets. They're much bigger than they were even in 2008. So if we have a meltdown, which are we going to have? Are we likely to have? Because, you know, the big banks have been lobbying and successfully lobbying to roll back the Dodd-Frank Act. So the big banks are almost back to the kind of gambling they were doing before. If we have another too big to fail bank, it's going to be even a bigger failure. And what happens to middle class? What happens to poor people? What happens to the rest of us if we go through another one of those people losing their homes, losing their jobs, losing their savings? We're not going to do that again. We must not do that again. So when Hillary comes to town, or Bernie, or anybody else, or any Republican you happen to see tonight at their dinner, what I want you to say are you willing to bust up the big banks? Use antitrust and bust up the big banks. These are real specific questions I want you to ask. Seriously. I mean, you in Iowa, you know, the reason I came to Iowa is because you guys get to ask the questions. I don't. I'm in California. I don't even see anybody. You think a single presidential candidate ever comes to California? Yeah, they come to troll for millionaire money occasionally, because there's some millionaire Democrats in California, but they don't come to talk to anybody. Your house is for sale in Iowa? Come here. I'm here. But you Iowans, you wait a minute. Wait, this is a very boisterous. What you have to do, I'm trying to help you. What you have to do is you've got to ask very specific, pointed questions. Not kind of, oh, are you worried about the middle class? No, you've got to be really specific. I mean, in terms of labor unions. What are you going to do to strengthen labor unions? Exactly. Are you going to resurrect? Are you going to try to get the Free Choice Act? Are you going to do that? Are you going to go after companies that try to bust unions? Are you going to make sure that no federal contractor who has tried to bust unions can ever be a federal contractor again? Are you going to do that? You see, you've got to be specific. You're going to raise the minimum wage? Are you actually going to raise the minimum wage at least to what it was in 1968? If not, I mean, if you added productivity improvements since 1968, the minimum wage today, hold your seats. I'm not advocating this, but I'm just telling you something. Because the typical American worker today is much, much, much more productive. Even a McDonald's worker is surrounded by much more machinery. The typical American worker today is far more productive than he or she was in 1968. So if you add in productivity improvements since 1968, adjust for them and for inflation, you know what the minimum wage would be today in this country? It would be $21 an hour. Now again, I'm realistic enough to think, no, that would get people too nervous. But think of that. So you say to the candidates, are you at least willing? You know, maybe it's got to be over 3 years. Are you going to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour and adjust for inflation thereafter? You know, the other side, this is a debate, by the way. I want to make sure we're all on the same page. Republicans are not our enemies. Can I just make, I know you're, I look at your faces, you're so skeptical when I say that. No, they're not your enemies. We are progressives. The enemies are the people who want to take us back to the 19th century. They are regressives. Now a lot of Republicans are regressives. There's some Democrats I've met who are regressives. There are a few Republicans, there used to be, they're now a vanishing species, progressives. Teddy Roosevelt, Abraham Lincoln. I mean, you have to go back a little bit to find them. But what progressives are talking about, we are talking about moving this nation forward with regard to rebuilding the middle class, making sure that anybody who works hard can actually not only be out of poverty, but also lift their families and have a better life for themselves, like we did before. We had a social contract. We had a social contract. It had three pieces. One piece was anybody who works full time must not be in poverty or their family. We all agreed. This is not. And that's why we have the minimum wage, why we have an earned income tax credit. That's why we work so hard. And most Americans believe this. They believe this. You know, the regressives say, oh, no. We've got to reduce the minimum wage. In fact, I heard the other day a regressive say, we ought to get rid of the minimum wage altogether. That will create more jobs. Well, by that logic, if we work for pennies an hour, we'd have jobs coming out of our ears. You know, slavery was a full employment system. The object is not jobs at any price. The object is good jobs with good pay and decent working conditions and decent benefits. So you ask the candidates specifically about that. And then you also ask the candidates about another regressive mythology that propaganda has propagandized almost to the point where people believe it. It's the big lie theory. You know, if you say the big lie over and over and over again, people start believing the big lie, even though there's no logic to it. You know, the big lie here is that CEOs and the wealthy are job creators. Have you heard that? You can't raise taxes on corporations and on big corporations and on CEOs because they're the job creators. And if you do that, they will stop being the job creators. Well, you know, here's the reality. The reality is that the job creators are a large and growing middle class, including enough places for people who are poor to ascend and aspire and move into the middle class, because middle class, a large and growing and buoyant middle class, has the purchasing power to buy the stuff that businesses want to sell. And if businesses don't have customers, there are going to be no jobs. And if businesses have a lot of new customers, they're going to create jobs. This is business 101. This is economics 1. And this is why you want to not only lift the minimum wage, but why you want to lift all of the wages of everybody in the median and below and maybe above median somewhat. Why you need, this is the logic of why you need strong unions. Why you need pay, because it's good for the economy. It's good for business. Businesses say, and a lot of the regressives say, oh no, we are the job creators. Corporations don't need tax cuts. They're sitting on $1.5 trillion of cash. They don't even know what to do with. They're buying back their own shares of stock. They're putting their cash all over the world. They don't know what to do with it. They're not investing because there are not enough customers. And people at the top, the billionaires and the multimillionaires, they don't need any more money to be incentivized. There's this bizarre propaganda machine that says somehow rich people need more money in order to have proper economic incentives and poor people need less money. Well, that doesn't make any sense economically. You want to actually create a situation in which poor people can aspire to have more money. You want to reward work and not reward wealth.
You're listening to Robert Reich from his May 16th appearance at the Working Families Summit in Ames. This is Heart of Iowa on KHOI Community Radio 89.1 FM.
And the third and major propaganda machine issue, it's not major, it's one of the three big ones, is that somehow entitlements, you've heard entitlements, they say it. Whenever they use the word entitlement, their noses wrinkle up. Entitlements. We have to, they're entitlements. We have too many entitlements. Well, I have news for them. Entitlements are social insurance in which we all pay into. Social Security, Medicare, we pay into these social insurance schemes. They are not entitlements make it sound like they're kids who are entitled. They're kind of rich kids who are running around entitled. Let's stop using the word entitlement, please. Let's talk about what they really are. They are social insurance systems that we pay into. Started in Social Security in the 1930s, Medicare 1965. I was a trustee of the Social Security and Medicare trust funds. I know of which I speak. Social Security, they want to say, is in dire straits. It's just going to go out of money. We have to raise the eligibility age. We've got to cut benefits. Baloney. You want to know how to save Social Security? In fact, we ought to expand Social Security. We ought to expand Social Security. We have too many seniors who have not had a chance to save because their wages have been suppressed and because they're getting no benefits, no pensions any longer. We used to have defined pensions in the 1950s, 1960s, and then they became defined contributions, and then they became do-it-yourself pensions, and then they became nothing. So Social Security needs to be expanded. How do we save Social Security and expand Social Security at the same time? Well, here's what we do. Right now, there is a cap on the percentage of income subjected to Social Security taxes. This year, it's going to be $118,500, which means anybody earning more than $118,500 pays nothing with regard to Social Security taxes on any dollar above $118,500. So a billionaire pays the same Social Security tax as somebody earning $118,500. Why don't we scrap the cap? And they want to say that Medicare is in trouble. Medicare is the most efficient system, social insurance system, that has been invented. It is incredibly efficient. Medicare is not the problem. Medicare out, I was a trustee. I was sitting there with the actuaries looking at all these data. If you ever have a sleep problem, anybody has a problem getting to sleep, I recommend you sit in those meetings with Medicare actuaries. So I would look at the data, and the thing is that Medicare is so much more efficient than private health insurance, because private health insurance is spending a fortune on advertising, on marketing, on trying to find healthy people and avoid sick people. We have the only healthcare system in the world that depends on avoiding sick people. So what we really ought to do is make it Medicare for all. That's the way we ought to go. And we can build on the Affordable Care Act. You just have at the state exchange level, you just make sure that at each state exchange, and certain states are already on the way to doing this, you put a Medicare option right there on the exchange. And it turns out, if you do that, it turns out the mathematics, Medicare becomes cheaper, and the more people that join Medicare, the cheaper it gets out of economies of scale, because it's also, its cost structure is much better, and you allow Medicare to use its bargaining leverage to get low drug prices. You see, this is not rocket science, folks. I mean, there are a lot of other things that we could talk about. Student debt has been talked about today already. Well, I mean, the simplest thing, students are paying 12, 13, 14% on those student debts. Let them refinance at 3 or 3.5%, which they could do right now, today, if the law allowed them to do that. Okay, but I said, if the law allowed them to do that. This is where the rigging comes in. Everything that I have talked about so far. And we could go down, I could talk. I belong to the Fidel Castro School of Oratory, which means I could talk for 4.5 hours and you would miss dinner and I'd miss my plane. My point is, no, I could go through the entire economy. I'm just giving you examples of how the rules could be changed to favor the middle class, working class, and the poor. It's not hard. What's hard is the politics, which gets back to this meeting, which gets back to Iowa, which gets back to the questions you're going to ask Hillary Clinton and Bernie and anybody else. The biggest enemy we have is not the regressives. The biggest enemy we have is cynicism. Because I go around the country and I talk to people all over this country, and they don't call themselves, most people don't call themselves liberals, conservatives, Democrats, Republicans. They really don't. Or even if they do, they don't have a strong sense of the label. Most people just are fed up. They feel, with regard to their corporation, their employer, they have no power at all. They're pissed off. With regard to, these big conglomerations, they're, as consumers, they can't deal with the AT&T or Comcast or the insurance companies or their healthcare, anything. The banks, they're fed up. They can't get through the call. Have you tried to get through these call menus? Or the airlines, there are now only four major airlines. You can't even, they have monopolies. There's so many monopolies. Let's bring back antitrust law. But most of all, people are cynical about, and this is dangerous, they're cynical about politics. This is where the regressives have won the most. They have created a country that is a democracy and one of the world's oldest and most functional democracies. It was. And they've turned us into cynics about our own government and our own political process. So most of all, when you talk to candidates, you've got to talk to them about how exactly they are going to get big money out of politics. What exactly are they going to do? What exactly are they going to do? They have got to support, for example, the Securities and Exchange Commission right now has petitions before it. You don't have to go through Congress. The SEC has petitions before it to require all corporations to disclose fully all of their campaign contributions. Now that is, the SEC could do that tomorrow by rulemaking. Why isn't the Obama administration doing that? Why? Every candidate should be supporting that, is simple and direct. Full disclosure generally of the sources of all campaign money. I mean, even the Supreme Court in that stupendously stupid decision. One of the worst decisions the Supreme Court has ever made, right up there with Gore against Bush and Dred Scott. The third worst decision, maybe as bad as those other two, was Citizens United and then McCutcheon. And you've got to ask the candidates, are you committed to appointing Supreme Court justices who are committed to reversing these decisions? Are you? Are you? And by the way, I will believe a corporation is a person when Texas executes a corporation. So in other words, the cynicism directly flows from all of the money and the sense of corruption. And people say, well, what can I possibly do? And then on top of that, you've got, a never-ending stream of poison from Fox News and Rush Limbaugh and the hate. You see, what's going on, and it's important that we squarely deal with this. It's not just cynicism, it's also the divide and conquer. Because you've got demagogues, starting with Fox News and hate radio, and right into a lot of the regressive precincts, and what they're doing is they're saying, your frustration, your anger, your cynicism, I understand it. You know why? It's because of them. And then they point the finger of blame at who? At the immigrants. Or the people of color. Or the union members or unions or government itself. You see, it's all that venom and all that hate there. They're capitalizing on the frustration and anger that so many Americans right now have. And they're saying, they're using the politics of resentment to divide us. So to take our economy back, to take our democracy back, what we've got to do is not only overcome the cynicism, but what we have to do is pull people together again. We have the numbers. We have the majority. We have the capacity. We've got to overcome their ability to sow cynicism and also hate and resentment. It's not going to be easy. Americans want truth-telling. They want authenticity. They want to know what is happening. They want to know why they are not getting ahead, and they want to know the truth. You are all organizers, whether you call yourself an organizer or not. You all know how to organize and mobilize and animate and educate. You know that. And the 9 months ahead, up until the primaries, and then beyond that, right up to the election, and then beyond that, right through 2017 and 18 and 19 and 20, this is not easy, but we are on the cusp, we are, of a new progressive movement. You are in the vanguard of a new progressive movement. It is happening. The fight for 15, the McDonald's fast food workers, the Walmart workers, the fight against the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which, as Larry said, is a travesty. It's a travesty. It's NAFTA on steroids. It's ridiculous. As Larry said, ask the candidates as they come through, are you, and particularly Hillary, are you going to support the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is going to even create fewer good jobs, erode wages, and also allow global companies to attack our health, safety, environmental, labor, financial regulations? Are you really in favor of that? It's you on the front line. That's why I came to Iowa. It's you. I'm here because I believe in you. And I need you, and the country needs you. So don't let us down. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. We have time for some questions. I've got to run off at four and get a plane, but let's discuss some of this. Let's have your questions. Anybody? And I'll repeat the question. So, yes, right here. Yes. Okay. Can I explain the Trans-Pacific Partnership a little bit more, since none of us have been able to read it? I know about it only because a lot of it has been leaked. You know, Edward Snowden. And what I know from the leakage, and I've also talked to a number of members of Congress, who they are having a hard time getting a hold of it because it's a classified document. It's classified for absolutely no good reason. But it's classified. But I can tell you what's in it. Basically, it has stronger intellectual property protections for pharmaceuticals. That means that pharmaceutical companies can keep their patents longer and guarantee their patents in other countries. Number two, it creates a special court, if you will, kind of a out of any nation's jurisdiction, a special tribunal that allows global companies, even U.S.-based global companies, to come there and basically say, we have been injured because this country's health or safety or environmental or labor or financial regulations have crimped our profits. And we, therefore, should be reimbursed by that country for the profits we've lost. And the tribunal members, who knows how they're going to be appointed? Probably by the same big corporations that created the tribunal in the first place. Already we have tobacco companies around the world using a similar provision that has been baked into other treaties to go after anti-smoking legislation in developing countries. And then we have obviously provisions that make it easier to move jobs abroad. Because you see, the more you protect the financial and physical assets of American companies abroad, the cheaper it becomes for them to outsource jobs. So if you think of this really as not a trade agreement, this is an investment agreement. And the president is justifying it now as, you know, and I think, and you may disagree with me or agree with me, I think Barack Obama will be known as one of the best presidents we've ever had. I really believe that. But on certain issues, he's wrong. And this is one of the issues that he is wrong on. And it's a big wrong. It's not just a small wrong. And we've got to raise our voices very loudly, and particularly if Hillary Clinton. You know, did I tell you, I once dated Hillary Clinton. I mean, before she was married. Do you want to know more about this? I don't think we have the time. You don't really want to know about this. Well, she was in college. She was president of her freshman class, and I was president of my sophomore class. We were at different colleges. And I suggested a presidential summit. And she came to my college and we saw a movie. It was Antonioni's Blow Up. Do you remember that movie? And now fast forward to 2008. In 2008, I got a call from the New York Times. A reporter at the New York Times said, you know, we found a collection of her letters from college and she mentions she went out on a date with you. And is there anything that you can tell me about that date that might shed light on how she will function as a president? So with my tongue firmly planted in my cheek, I, because it was such an absurd question, I said, well, all I remember is that she wanted an absurd amount of butter on her popcorn. And then there was silence. And I thought he had hung up. I said, hello. And he said, are you still there? He said, oh yes, I'm just writing this down. Any other question? Yes. Well, let me say two things about that. One is that you've got to give these candidates the courage of their conviction by delivering the message I just delivered. Because they, you know, once you are a candidate, and Bernie's a good friend, and Hillary's a good friend, and I know, you know, I don't know many of the Republicans, that's true. But you just have to hammer home to them the message I just gave you. The other thing that's very important, and you can never forget this, is you must not set yourself up to think of the next president as the savior. Because I don't know about you, I've fallen for that almost too many times now. Because the more we think that the next president, if we get him or her elected, is the Messiah, the more we are going to be disappointed. Nobody can do it alone. Nobody can do it. Everybody, any human being, has got to, yes, you set direction and you try to inspire people, but you've got to have people mobilized behind you to get anything done. I mean, even in the presidential election of 1936, and I don't remember that election personally, but even in the presidential election of 1936, Franklin D. Roosevelt was asked by a constituent, Mr. President, if I reelect you, if I vote for you for reelection and you are reelected, I want you to do this, 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 and this, a list of five things. And he turned to this constituent and said, ma'am, if I'm reelected, I want to do all of those things, but you must make me. And he meant, even in the depths of the Depression, people had to be mobilized and organized and energized and activated. And so our job does not end with a president being elected. And I think too often we think it does. It just begins. We have time for a couple more. Yep. Am I ever threatened by the wealthy? What are they going to do to me? I mean, what are they going to do? I actually did once. In my office and also at home, same day, I got an envelope with powder in it. Seriously. And I turned it over to the FBI, and about 3 months later, I heard that it was talcum powder. 3 months, I thought, God, you know, I'm not long for this world. But no, don't ever, anybody here, be afraid to speak the truth. Don't be afraid. Yes. How does the war on terror and foreign policy in the Middle East fit in? A couple of ways. Number one, we're spending $750 billion a year on the military. That is more than the 10 next largest military budgets, including Russia and China, together. There is no good reason why we have to spend that much, and we can maintain our national security on much less. The bloat is there. It is, when I talked about the big banks and I talked about pharmaceuticals, I could easily also have talked about military contractors. They're another, and Eisenhower knew that. Eisenhower was talking about that. I mean, we forget. I mean, Ike even looks good now. At the time, I thought he was sort of an old fuddy-duddy and right wing. So that's one thing. The second thing we've got to keep in mind is that the same people who advised George W. Bush to go into Iraq are now advising a bunch of these Republican candidates. They have never been held accountable, these people. And we've got to hold them accountable. You know, why is Wolfowitz back there advising Jeb? Most Americans want the minimum wage raised significantly. And this is true. We had four states in the midterm elections, Arkansas, Nebraska, South Dakota, and Alaska, all had minimum wage increases on their ballots. They all agreed. They all are red states. They approved those minimum wage increases. The Democrats running in those states, they lost. They didn't even talk about the minimum wage. I mean, it's very popular. When I went in 1996 to Bill Clinton and said, we should raise the minimum wage. We haven't done it in years. And he said, really? Do you think so? I said, yes, we'll do a poll. And he turned to Dick Morris, one of the worst people in America, who was then his pollster. And Dick Morris did a poll overnight. He came to me the next morning. He was amazed. He said, 85% of Americans want the minimum wage increased. I don't know how to this day Dick Morris did overnight polls so quickly. I think he polled his family. That's what he did. But we took the, and there were other polls that showed it wasn't just the Dick Morris poll. This is incredibly popular. Most Americans believe in three fundamental moral principles. And that's, let me end on this. And this is Democrats, Republicans, this is right across the board. This is 80% by poll, focus group poll, three basic fundamental moral principles. Number one, I mentioned, nobody should work full time and be in poverty or their family. That's really broadly accepted. Number two, everybody should have an opportunity to make the most of their native God-given talents and abilities. That's why education is popular. Even though we're fighting a lot bad like education, most people don't think we're testing too much. We are testing too much. Most people actually think teachers should be paid more. And the third moral principle, and I'll end on this one, is that we should not have a privileged aristocracy in this country. This is something the founding fathers of our republic understood and fought for in the revolution and beyond. But we are on the way to creating a permanent privileged aristocracy. And that's why raising the inheritance tax back to what it was in the 1990s is so important. That's why we need to bust up the big banks. That's why we need campaign finance limits and reform. We've got to prevent a permanent privileged aristocracy from forming in this country. These are basic moral principles that everybody agrees to. Thank you all. Good luck. Good night.
You've been listening to Heart of Iowa on KHOI Community Radio. Today's show brought you the keynote address by Robert Reich from the May 16th Working Families Summit in Ames, sponsored by a collection of labor groups and progressive organizations from Iowa. Robert Reich was the former Secretary of Labor under President Bill Clinton and is the director of the recent film Inequality for All, which won an award at the 2013 Sundance Film Festival. I've been your host, Greta Anderson. Richard Morrison engineered the show, and our music is The Fisherman by Leo Kottke. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.